Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to the FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, March 24th, 2025, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument program on Louisiana versus Calais, which was argued earlier today before the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, but if you'd like to know more, you can access his impressive full bio at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Michael Domino, who is a professor of law at Widener University Commonwealth Law School, where he teaches courses related to constitutional law, election law, federal courts, statutory interpretation, and criminal law. He is a two-time recipient of Widener's Douglas E. Ray Award for Faculty Scholarship, a two-time recipient of Widener's Outstanding Professor Award, an elected member of the American Law Institute, and a Fulbright Scholar. Mike has written extensively on constitutional law, free speech, and election law, and has co-authored several books, including Voting Rights and Election Law, Congressional Investigations and Oversight, The Best Candidate, Presidential Nomination in Polarized Times, and Understanding Election Law and Voting Rights. And I will leave it there. A last note, throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that extended portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mike, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Kayla. Thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this. Thanks to all of you for watching. It's an honor to be with you. Today's case, Louisiana versus Calais, involves a conflict that has repeated itself through the last several years in a few different Supreme Court cases. It's a conflict between Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and the 14th Amendment, which Section 2 is ostensibly enforcing. Section 2 says that members of racial minority groups shall have an equal opportunity to access the political process and to elect representatives of their choice. Whereas the Equal Protection Clause, of course, requires that states provide to people within their jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act has been interpreted to require states in some circumstances to draw majority-minority districts. Section 2 doesn't say majority-minority districts in so many words, but the Supreme Court, in cases coming back to the 1986 case of Thornburg versus Jingles, have established certain preconditions for successful Section 2 claims that basically say that if a minority group is concentrated in the state such that a district could be drawn in a compact area, and drawing those compact majority-minority districts would provide the minority group with a roughly proportionate amount of representation in Congress or in a state legislature, then the state is obligated to draw those districts. The state is not obligated to draw non-compact districts just to achieve a proportional representation of the minority group. But there is an obligation to draw districts, at least where those districts can be drawn in a compact way. The 14th Amendment, on the other hand, imposes a kind of limit on Section 2 claims and says that the state may not draw districts, what we have come to call racially gerrymandered districts, if the state in drawing those districts is predominantly concerned with race. That is, when the state is drawing districts, it can consider race. It's allowed to consider race. We don't have a purely colorblind district drawing system here under the 14th Amendment. But the rule is you can't consider race too much. So consider race a little bit. Consider race, in fact, under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, you have to consider race enough to create these majority-minority districts. But don't consider race too much, because if race predominates in the decision of where to draw these district lines, then you've violated the 14th Amendment and you've created this unconstitutional racial gerrymander. So that's the legal background of this case. Now on to the specific claims here and the factual circumstances that went on in Louisiana. Louisiana redrew its districts like all states do after the census, and its district lines didn't change very much from the districts that were in effect prior to the 2020 census. It had six districts. One of them was majority-minority. That district map was challenged as a violation of Section 2. And the claim was that that Louisiana would have created a second compact majority-minority district. And because it could have, it should have. And the district court that heard that claim agreed on the preliminary injunction stage. That is, the district court concluded that there was a substantial likelihood of the challenger's success on that Section 2 claim. And the district court said, again, not after trial, but at the preliminary injunction stage, the district court said that it appears that you could draw a second, relatively compact majority-minority district in addition to the one that was already in the New Orleans area by combining various pockets of Black populations stretching basically down the eastern side of Louisiana and connecting with East Baton Rouge. You could draw a district that way that wouldn't look too crazy, wouldn't look like a gerrymander that was unprecedented, and would allow Blacks to have control of a second out of the six Louisiana districts. The state, however, was not especially pleased with this idea, because drawing the district in that way would have eliminated, would have caused the ouster of a particular Republican representative in Congress, Julia Letlow. There were alternative ways that the district could be drawn, but one of those ways would have been to jeopardize the reelection of Speaker Mike Johnson. So the Louisiana legislature said, well, we better go back to the drawing board. The district court is going to make us draw a second majority-minority district, so we have to change the plan that we had come up with. And if we don't do anything, if we don't pass any plan, then the district court is going to impose a plan on us, and that one's going to be one that we don't like. So we'd better sort of from the legislature's perspective, or the Republican legislators' perspective in Louisiana, we'll make the best of a bad situation. We'll create a second majority-minority district, give Democrats two seats in Louisiana, but we'll keep Mike Johnson, Steve Scalise, and Julie Letlow in office, and we'll create a second majority-minority district in a different area. So that's what the Louisiana legislature did. It created a different plan that had two majority-minority districts, but the second majority-minority district, the one that's challenged in this case, it's District 6, is a very snake-like district, to use Chief Justice Roberts's way of describing it in the oral argument today. It goes throughout east to west, a very large area of the state. It's a very thin district, a bunch of tendrils sticking out. If you look at it, it's pretty clear that it's gerrymandered for some kind of reason. And the challengers in this case brought a suit claiming that it was an unconstitutional racial gerrymander, as they drew the district so as to have a majority of minority races, Blacks in particular, in the district. And so the challengers said, this is a racial gerrymander, race predominated, look at the district. In fact, you can just read the statements of the legislative sponsors, who were quite upfront about their position that they wouldn't be redrawing these districts at all if it weren't for the district court's view that it was necessary to draw a second majority-minority district to comply with the Voting Rights Act. So the challengers said, well, if they wouldn't have redrawn these districts at all, and if when they redrew the districts, the one thing they couldn't compromise was race, because after all, creating the second majority-minority district was the whole reason for the enterprise, then race must have predominated. And if race predominated, then the redrawing was an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. Now, the state comes back and says, no, race wasn't the only factor that we couldn't compromise. Yes, it's true, of course, that we wouldn't be redrawing these districts at all if it weren't for race. But we have to redraw the districts because the Voting Rights Act requires us to, and we really have no alternative. So yes, race is relevant to that extent, but if that makes it unconstitutional, then that basically makes the forced drawing of majority-minority districts under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional. And so yes, we did consider race to that extent, but the question of where this district would be located was determined not just by race, but also by politics. That is, we drew District 6 in this thin, snake-like way, rather than drawing it in a way that looked better, because we preferred the political outcomes that we would get under a snake-like district compared to the political outcomes that we would get in a different district, in a district more like the district court would have imposed on us had we not drawn up a plan ourselves. The challengers say that doesn't make any difference. It still means that that race predominated in the drawing of the district. After all, you drew this district in such a way as to capture groups of Black voters so that you would get a sufficient number to satisfy the district court. And because race was the one factor, or at least you couldn't compromise race, then that meant that race predominated. And that's really what the case is about, whether the placement of this district or the choice of what portion of the state the legislature wants to draw a majority-minority district in, whether if that choice is based on politics, does that mean that race doesn't predominate? Or to phrase it the other way, to phrase it in a way like the challengers would state it, does race predominate in the construction of a majority-minority district once the state says, we must create a majority-minority district? We will do whatever is necessary to group in enough members of this minority group. Is that by itself enough to mean that race predominates, even if even if the state chooses to draw the district in one place rather than another for reasons that are not totally concerned with race or that involve politics in addition to involving race? That is the heart of the case, and the big theoretical issue that has never quite been decided by the court is what it means for race to have predominated. Justice Gorsuch got to this point in his oral argument when he asked straight out, he said, what does it mean for race or politics to predominate? And you would think that because that's the standard that the court has established, the court would have given us some idea of what it means, but the court has not, or has said some conflicting things. On the one hand, it says race predominates if it is the consideration that can't be compromised. On the other hand, you would think, well, under that approach, anytime you're intentionally creating a majority-minority district, that must mean that race predominates, because you can't compromise race or you wouldn't create the extra majority-minority district. So it's sort of hard to say how race couldn't predominate among district line drawers who are insisting on the creation of a majority-minority district. But the court has also said that just because you're intentionally creating a majority-minority district does not necessarily mean that race predominates. The court has heard a couple of cases in which it has indicated that that it is possible for a state to intentionally draw a majority-minority district and yet for race not to predominate in the construction of those districts. So the court says, well, how can race not predominate there? And the court's basic answer is, well, you have to be considering other things too. Things like incumbency protection, things like maintaining connections to communities of interest, things like not splitting municipal boundaries, creating compact districts where possible. Those, what the court calls traditional redistricting criteria. So if you're using traditional redistricting criteria and you're creating a majority-minority district by considering race within the, while also considering those other factors, then according to the court, race may not be predominating. Now, here, what went on here seems to, at least arguably, is a little stronger than that, because although the court is, although the Louisiana legislature did consider politics at some point in the line drawing process, the political considerations came in only after the racial determination had been set. So race wasn't just sort of one of the factors to be mixed in to the hopper. The racial determination was made, and then after that, politics determined how that racial threshold was going to be met. So again, the challengers say that the case is distinguishable from those past cases. The state, on the other hand, says, you're putting us between a rock and a hard place. If you tell us that we have to create this second majority minority district, and yet the way that we did it is unconstitutional because we considered race too much, you're making the creation of these districts an impossible task. And indeed, it was the state is in something of a sympathetic position here, because its initial map was rejected on the preliminary injunction stage by the court. So the federal courts say, well, you can't have the districts that you wanted. And then it draws up something else, creates the second majority minority district, and it gets sued from the other side. And the judges, the lower court judges in the case that is here under review, they split 2-1, but the majority said that this is an unconstitutional racial gerrymander because race predominated in the drawing of these district lines. So Louisiana is basically at the court saying, give us a break. We got to draw these lines, and you're making the task impossible for us. And that argument was picked up by the three liberal justices on the court, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson, in various ways suggested that the state needs to be given this kind of leeway to create a remedy for a Section 2 violation. If the Voting Rights Act requires Louisiana to draw a second majority minority district, then the law should, in their view, give them the freedom to decide more or less where in the state to put that district, even if the district turns out to be non-compact. Challengers, on the other hand, appeared to be supported by Justice Alito and Justice Gorsuch. The rest of the justices didn't speak too much and made statements that weren't as easy to pin down. But the challengers say it does matter where in the state you place the district. When you have a Section 2 violation, you cannot remedy it with a non-compact district. That is to say, you can't say these Black voters in the northeast part of the state had their rights violated under the Voting Rights Act because you didn't draw a majority-minority district there. And you're going to remedy that harm by giving some other Black voters in some other part of the state a majority minority district. Challengers say you can't do that. You have to remedy the Section 2 violation by creating a district that gives voting power to the people who, under the Voting Rights Act, have the right to have that voting power. And the state says, well, we don't have to draw exactly the same district that the district court would have preferred. And in fact, even though this new snake-like District 6 looks very different from the one that the district court drew, because of where the population centers are, close to 70% of the Black voters in the original proposed district are in the district as the legislature drew it up. So the state says it's not quite as different as it might be, or as you might think that it is just from the way that it looks. But again, the court's standards for deciding these kinds of questions, in short, sort of how much overlap there has to be between the minority community that is entitled to this Voting Rights Act protection and the minority community that is captured in the newly drawn district, courts never decided how much overlap is required to make out a successful remedy for a Section 2 violation. So in summary, what I'll go back to the what I think is the most crucial question involved in the case. It's how do we determine whether race predominates in the drawing of these district lines? And so far as the court seems to say that you can create a majority-minority district on purpose and yet race doesn't predominate, as long as you consider other kinds of factors like politics and incumbency protection, you're really going to water down the racial gerrymandering claim. State that again in a little different way, that a successful racial gerrymandering claim requires the challengers to be able to convince the court that race predominated in the drawing of district lines. And if it's not enough to make that claim to say, well, they on purpose put a certain number of a minority group voters into this district for the express purpose of creating a majority-minority district, then it's going to be really difficult to bring successful claims for racial gerrymandering causes of action. So we'll see in late June what the court does. There are narrow and broad ways to decide this case, and that seems always to be the case in these redistricting cases. You never know whether a case is going to be an important case, a landmark case, or not until the court's opinion is handed down. It might very well be that this case is decided based on the specific facts of this case. Certainly the challengers are saying this is just a plain vanilla racial gerrymandering cause of action, just like a whole bunch of other districts that you struck down before. Whereas the Louisiana government is trying to say that this case is significantly different from those. So depending on how broadly the court decides to fashion its ruling, that will affect what the long-term significance of this case is. Again, thanks for all of your attention. Caleb, back to you.
Well, thank you so much for that summary of the sort of extensive history of this case and how we got to where we are, as well as the issues that were put forward at oral argument. As we transition into our time of question and answer, I'll issue a reminder to our audience that if you've got questions, you can submit those via the Q&A feature. And while those come in, I'd love to pose a couple of my own, sort of kick things off. I really appreciated sort of the summary of the preceding case and how we had the first map and litigation around that. Because it came up at oral argument a little bit, I'd love to dive slightly deeper into the options that were available to Louisiana after the first preliminary injunction on map one was upheld. There seemed to be a little bit of debate as to whether or not they were actually bound by that injunction, what they could have done with that. So what were the options for Louisiana once the Fifth Circuit said, once the Fifth Circuit had ruled in the first case?
You're right that the court did talk about that for a significant amount this morning. The Fifth Circuit had said, we're going to affirm the preliminary injunction issued by the district courts. You can't use the map that you drew up. We think that's an unconstitutional violation. A violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. We think you need to create a second majority-minority district. The Fifth Circuit then put a deadline on the state and said, well, if you can do two things. You can either do nothing and let the district court create a second majority-minority district, which would have created the risk to the incumbent member of Congress that the state didn't want to do. Or you can draw more districts yourself. And that's what Louisiana decided to do. Now, because it was only at the preliminary injunction stage, the state could have said, all right, enjoin us now, but we're not going to concede that there was a Voting Rights Act violation. We think the way that we drew the districts the first time is perfectly fine under the Voting Rights Act, so we want a trial. And maybe at the end of that trial, the state would have won and they would have been able to continue with the map as they had first drawn it up. But they wouldn't have been able to do that for the then upcoming election, because the Fifth Circuit was not going to allow the map that Louisiana had drawn up initially to be used for in the short term. That one was preliminarily enjoined. So the state could have gone to trial to defend its initial choice, but it said, given the necessities of time, it would be better to concede defeat on that claim and to say, well, our realistic choice is between creating the second majority-minority district that the district court would impose on us or creating one that we think is better.
Got it. Because it was discussed in oral argument as to how much reliance Louisiana could put on this sort of preliminary injunction finding, is there a world where this case could have gone differently if they litigated it all the way through, lost, redrawn this map, and then this came to the Supreme Court as, hey, this is violative of the 14th Amendment? Is the fact it was at the preliminary injunction stage matter to the conversation on whether or not race was determinative in this case, or is that sort of separate but interesting as we talk about the facts?
We'll see how much that matters. It certainly seemed to get different amounts of attention from different justices on the court today. The state's argument is that we need to defend our use of race in creating District 6. And our defense is that we were going to violate the Voting Rights Act if we didn't do something, if we didn't create this second majority-minority district. More particularly, the state says the district court and the Fifth Circuit had already warned us that we would likely be violating the Voting Rights Act if we didn't draw a second majority-minority district. Even if they turn out to be wrong, so even if we didn't really need to draw a second majority-minority district, at least we had a strong basis in evidence for thinking that we needed to draw the second district. And that's what the state says the appropriate standard is. Standard is not whether we actually were violating the Voting Rights Act with our first plan, but whether we had a strong basis in evidence for thinking that we needed to create a second majority-minority district. And the district court's opinion and the Fifth Circuit's opinion gives us that strong basis in evidence for thinking that we needed to draw the second majority-minority district. The challengers say, well, then you're basically giving preclusive effect to a preliminary injunction determination. And just because the state decides to throw in the towel Now you got an excuse to draw district lines where race predominates. And even if compliance with the Voting Rights Act should be a compelling reason and an excuse for otherwise considering race too much, even if compliance with the Voting Rights Act is necessary, you're not really demonstrating that compliance with the Voting Rights Act is necessary. You're just saying that you were worried about the district court and the Fifth Circuit possibly deciding against you. Well, you should have to stick to your guns. But the so that's additionally part of what this case is going to be about, that Justice Alito and Justice Gorsuch in particular suggested that that maybe that kind of deference to the preliminary findings of these lower courts is inappropriate. Justice Barrett obliquely referred to the same kind of concern. On the other hand, Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Jackson were quite clear that nothing more should be required than this substantial basis in evidence for thinking that there might be a Section 2 violation if they don't draw the second majority-minority district.
Got it. Thanks so much. You touched on this a little bit in your sort of summary of transition from Map 1 to Map 2, but what are the requirements, if any, when a state is considering how to draw districts? There's a little bit of conversation on, will they have to be compact? No, compactness doesn't actually have a requirement. In this case, because it's sort of solving a problem that has been articulated for them, they have to consider race to some degree. But what are the considerations that are typically put forward in drawing a district? And do those differ from sort of remedial district drawing, where you've been told answer one is wrong, you have to do it a different way?
Court calls traditional redistricting criteria are such matters as municipal boundary lines, towns, counties, et cetera. And the basically what map drawers do is they take the existing map, they see where populations have shifted because they need to keep the same number of people in all the districts to comply with the one person, one vote rule. And then they see, well, how can we move these lines as little as possible to comply with one person, one vote? So one traditional redistricting criterion is the sort of continuation of as much of as possible of the old map with the new map. But sometimes a whole bunch of changes are necessary because there's been a large population shift, or the state gains or loses a congressional seat. So you really have to redo the lines if you're changing the number of districts to draw. And when you do that, the court says that there is no constitutional requirement of drawing compact districts. There's no constitutional requirement that you adhere to political boundary lines, county lines, and that kind of thing. The only constitutional requirement is that you have the same number of people in each district. But because we have this limitation on the consideration of race, you can't consider race too much. The states end up pointing to those traditional redistricting criteria and whatever other kinds of considerations they use, like politics, as a way of explaining why they didn't consider race too much. So it's, you might think this district looks weird, and you might assume that it's because of race. But no, that's not what was going on here. Here's what we were trying to do. We were trying to keep the core of this community together, or we were trying to protect these incumbents, or we were trying to maximize the advantage for the party that was in control of the state legislature, or whatever it is. So so while we have a rule that you can't consider race too much, we don't have a rule that says you must consider these other kinds of things. Instead, what we have is the way that you prove that you didn't consider race too much is by pointing to the other traditional factors that you did consider.
Thanks so much. So turning a little bit from sort of the pieces that led up to oral argument itself. First, we heard from three different arguers. Yes, could you sort of break down who they were and why they were talking to the court?
Well, two were on one side and one was on the other. You have the state and an interest group supporting the state that was challenging the initial line drawing, the initial creation of the map. And then you have the challengers on the other side, represented by Eddie Grime, who's a member of our free speech and election law practice group executive committee. So the first two arguers were supporting the state's creation of this District 6, and the third one was attacking it. There's an interesting kind of conflict, ideological conflict sort of, between the first two groups. That while they were on the same side in this case, they were on the opposite sides in the earlier case. So when Louisiana first draws up the district, the map plan that creates one majority minority district, that plan is challenged by the interest groups that want the creation of a second majority minority district. And they prevailed, as we've talked about at the preliminary injunction stage. Well, as a result, the legislature goes back to the drawing board, creates the second majority minority district, and then gets sued. So not only is the state defending its plan, but the interest groups that initially sued for the creation of a second majority minority district are joining the state in defending the new plan from the attack by others. So the people who had proposed the alternative map that seemed to gain acceptance by the district court, they're now defending a map that's different from the one that they drew up, but one that creates a second majority minority district. So it's better for them than if the challengers were to win this case.
Got it. Thanks so much. So now where are we at with this point of litigation? I know you mentioned in the first case, it was all the preliminary injunction stage. Have we passed the preliminary injunction stage in this case? Are we talking, have all the facts been brought out? Are we still litigating?
We are still litigating. It's rather peculiar. The Supreme Court stayed the proceedings with the three-judge district court. So if, at least if the challengers were to win the case, that is, if the lower court decision were to be affirmed, there would be a remand back to the three-judge district court with more proceedings this fall. If the state were to win, then I'm not sure whether there's more to be done. The state would say that district map is good. It might depend on what the rationale that the Supreme Court uses, whether the Supreme Court just outright reverses or whether it says that more findings as to something or other is necessary. But as for now, because the Supreme Court stayed the proceedings, the record has some gaps in it. And part of the challenger's argument is that more would have been brought out and more will be brought out if there are more proceedings below.
Okay, thanks so much. So you mentioned five of the justices, sort of Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson, sort of where they were generally falling, as well as Alito and Gorsuch. For the four outstanding, what was their questioning like? Did they give a sense of where they might be leaning or some of the issues that really felt salient as they were considering the case?
Justice Thomas spoke a couple of times and asked variations on the same question. He was particularly interested in knowing what the source of the original Section 2 violation was. He has criticized the Section 2 litigation in the past in prior opinions, and he didn't explain here. He didn't go into any detail on how he thought that the case should be resolved, but he seemed to be interested in whether it was appropriate to find that there was a Section 2 violation in the first place, whether the initial map as drawn up by the Louisiana legislature was a Section 2 violation, and if it was, what the nature of that violation was, who was violated, how were their rights violated. So because of his general skepticism toward these kinds of claims, I suspect that he is sympathetic to the challenger's argument, but he did not go into a lot of detail on that. Chief Justice Roberts didn't say very much at all. He did indicate that he thought that the snake-like pattern of this district demonstrated that race was a factor, and he asked whether it was possible to think that race couldn't be the predominant factor given the shape of the district. But he didn't say anything that was really pressing one side or another. He didn't tip his hand as to how he'd come out in the case. Similarly, Justices Barrett and Kavanaugh spoke a little bit, not terribly much, and didn't say much that would, at least in my view, I didn't pick up on any kind of clear signal about where they were likely to end up. And chances are that their votes are going to be really important in determining which side wins. Nobody was expecting Alito, Jackson, Sotomayor, or Kagan to be a swing vote in this case. So their apparent positions are not a surprise to, I assume, to anybody. But it's difficult for me to tell at this point which way the crucial middle of the court is going to be leaning.
Sounds good. Were there any arguments you were surprised to see pop up at oral argument from either side?
It was sort of surprised that I wasn't surprised by anything. Usually, nice. When I listen to these oral arguments, I think, boy, I didn't see that one coming. But there wasn't much here. What all sides on the court seemed to be interested in was what was a fairly predictable concern. It is a little bit odd, in a way, for the justices who are probably most supportive of the aims of the Voting Rights Act and who would be inclined to read the Voting Rights Act most expansively, for them to come to the state's defense here and say, oh, the state needs a lot of flexibility in deciding how to address these Section 2 violations. This is an odd case that way, because we have the state taking a position that we didn't want to draw this second majority minority district, but we're going to defend it anyway. And the challenge is brought from people who are sort of on the politically conservative side of this issue that says, we want to challenge the way the state of Louisiana drew these lines because it's considering race too much. You might expect these Voting Rights Act cases to present a different kind of political valence, where, especially if you're thinking about it from civil rights era kind of terms, with the southern state is attacked for not considering race enough or for not giving enough political power to the minority group. Here, it's the other way, that the state is being attacked for considering race too much.
And was there anything that was surprising not to see pop up at OA?
There was a lot in this case that the ways that it could go. The state spent a good amount of time in its brief talking about standing and suggested that the court revisit the rules that have been in place since the mid-90s about who is permitted to come into court to challenge a redistricting. That the rule that the court has established is, if you're in the gerrymandered district, you have the ability to sue, whether you're Black, white, or anything else. And if you're outside the district, then you don't, again, if you're Black, white, or anything else. So standing doesn't depend on whether you're a member of the minority group or not. It depends on whether you're inside this gerrymandered district or not. And the state says, with some justification that whatever kind of harm is caused by the creation of a gerrymandered district affects everybody in the state. It doesn't just affect the people who are in the district. It affects the people who would be in the district, except that they're drawn out of the district because the district has this weird shape. And so the standing rules that the court has established are arbitrary. And so the state invited the court to revisit those rules, but there was no question, unless I missed it, there was no discussion at all about that issue. And the court, I have to assume, is just going to stick with the standing rules that have been established in these other cases and to proceed to the merits of the Section 2 issue and the 14th Amendment issue.
Okay. Well, transitioning then with sort of 15-ish minutes left from oral argument to the potential ramifications of this case, there are two sort of major things floating in the background, if I understand correctly. The first is, depending on how this comes out, how the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act interplays with the 14th Amendment. And the second is Robinson, which I think Justice Thomas, you can correct me, was pretty like, hey, was this decided correctly? And where do you stand, Louisiana? There's some back and forth on that. Could either of those be addressed in the way this decision comes out in sort of an explicit way? Or are those sort of just floating in the background, but this case will likely be decided on something else or something more narrow?
Well, the conflict between Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and the 14th Amendment is central to the case. So the court will definitely say something about that, whether it says something in such a way that's going to resolve this case and set some kind of standard that can be applied easily in the future. I think it's anyone's guess. We'll have to see how broadly the court reads it. The Robinson case that you mentioned is the first version of the litigation in this case. So when Louisiana first drew the district lines, the challenge to those lines, the challenger saying you must draw a second minority district, that was the Robinson litigation. So the justices, Justice Alito, for example, who suggested that the Robinson case was wrongly decided, what they're saying is that the lower courts should not have made Louisiana create a second majority minority district. That was an incorrect interpretation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And the question for the court now is, can we refight that battle? Or is the only thing that matters that the district court and the Fifth Circuit suggested that there is a likelihood of a Section 2 violation? And once you reach that point, you don't actually have to ever to decide whether there really is a Section 2 violation. Once you reach that preliminary injunction stage, the state then has a strong basis in evidence for thinking that they need to draw the second majority minority district. The state draws the majority minority district, and then we're just sort of stuck with that prior decision. And that was what Justice Barrett remarked. She said that the way that the state would have it would give what amounts to preclusive effect to a preliminary determination by a lower court, and that there would be no way for someone to other, if the state throws in the towel, there would be no way for anyone else to fully to litigate whether Section 2 required the creation of this district, that the state would just be able to rely on its strong basis for thinking that it was, and then because of meeting that standard, it would be able to consider race in a way that otherwise might violate the 14th Amendment.
Got it. Following up on that, do we know or do we have examples of what sort of the precedential effect of this would be if, assuming the court rules in favor of Louisiana and Louisiana has relied on this preliminary injunction determination as reason enough, if not good law, and then assuming the court agrees with them. They've also said, hey, that reliance is reasonable at the very least. If not, hey, this preliminary injunction was enough. How does one treat that determination or that decision, given that the issue wasn't fully litigated? Do you just take it as fact? Is it very narrow because we didn't get a full scope? What's sort of the potential precedential impact of this if the court rules in favor of Louisiana?
Yeah, I think that that's one thing that the court will talk about in its decision, what the answer to that question is. What we know from prior cases is that the state can't just think on its own, oh, I'm worried about a Section 2 violation, so I'm going to create as many majority-minority districts as I can. That the state just can't do that itself. And the state can't even hide behind the federal Justice Department if the state were to say, well, we need to create a second majority-minority district because otherwise, under the prior preclearance regime, we're not going to get preclearance from the Justice Department unless we satisfy the Justice Department. That means creating more majority-minority districts. The Supreme Court has said that's not a good enough reason. You need to have a strong basis in evidence, and it's not just enough that you caved to the Justice Department. Caving to Article III judges might be a different story. That's the one thing that might distinguish this case from prior cases like Bush versus Vera that involved very similar facts, states creating majority-minority districts, combining various disparate populations of the state just to get enough minority voters, districts that were struck down because race was considered too much. In those cases also, the state said, well, we had to consider race because we had to worry about the Voting Rights Act. And the court said, well, we don't know that you would have had to worry about the Voting Rights Act because you didn't have a definitive ruling about what the Voting Rights Act requires because you didn't go to court. Now, Louisiana says, well, we didn't get a final judgment. We didn't go to trial in the Robinson case. We don't know for sure, but we have a pretty strong indication from these preliminary rulings, and we should be able to rely on that. So that's the narrow version of this case. If this case is going to be decided narrowly, it's going to be focused on that distinction, and the court can decide whether it makes a difference that the state's strong basis in evidence comes from court ruling, albeit a preliminary ruling, versus the state's own determination or the Justice Department.
Got it. Well, I'll ask the opposite question then, which is, what are the potential ramifications of this case if the court sides with Calais or against the state of Louisiana? Do they immediately have to redraw their map? What can they consider if/when they do that? Are there other potential ramifications coming out of that?
Yes, there are. So that there, if Calais wins, then the case is nowhere near over because you're going to have to, as I said, you're going to have to go back for proceedings on remand. The state is going to say, all right, if we can't draw District 6, then we're going to have to come up with something else. And there are a couple of different ways that it could go from there. You could go back to the second majority-minority district that the district court initially seemed to suggest was a likely possibility, the one that that the state rejected for political reasons, incumbency protection reasons. So you could adopt that, create a second majority-minority district, and get bad political consequences for Louisiana Republicans. Or you might, what Calais is hoping for is that on remand, that the a trial would be able to demonstrate that it isn't really necessary at all to create a second majority-minority district. And so what they're hoping is that these remanded proceedings would give the state the green light to create a district map plan similar to what Louisiana wanted to draw in the first place. So you have... It really is not clear what would happen at that point. You'd certainly would have the combination of interests that support Louisiana in this case would divide again. because Louisiana would welcome the opportunity to go back to its original plan. But you have the possibility that Louisiana would end up being stuck with its third choice plan, the one that it really doesn't want. But that one, we're a long way from figuring out how the districts would look if this case is affirmed.
Got it. Okay, so you've mentioned sort of the narrow option here. What is the broad decision that could come out of this?
The broad decision would be actually to tell us something about how to determine when race predominates in the drawing of district lines. How much consideration of race is okay, when that consideration of race is allowed to come in, how it has to be balanced with other kinds of factors. So if the court really explains why race did or did not predominate in the drawing of the maps in this case, that might be more helpful in setting a kind of rule going forward. What it's done in some of the past cases is to say, well, that's a factual determination. Whether race predominated or not is just a factual determination in the individual case. And so we'll just sort of hide behind the fact finding made below. Sometimes the court overturns the fact finding below as clearly erroneous, and then it's really difficult to understand what the court's doing. But we have this, these are always so difficult because politics and race are so intertwined that the for these cases to be brought, you have to establish that the minority community votes in a coherent way, as they solidify behind a particular point of view or choice of candidates, and that the majority in the state votes against that minority point of view. And so what you end up having is that the side that protects minority voting rights, or that claims the protections of the Voting Rights Act, is also politically the group that is benefited from whatever the political opinions of the minority group are. Another implication of that is that a state like Louisiana, that is where Republicans have an advantage, will draw district lines to advantage Republicans, but because the minority voters lean more towards Democrats, that a pro-Republican gerrymander can look like it's disadvantaging Democrats, which is not as much of a problem, just political gerrymandering, or it disadvantages blacks who support Democrats, which then looks like more of a racial districting decision, which is more problematic. And it's the same in the opposite. If you're trying to avoid a Section 2 violation and you want to give an extra advantage to blacks who support Democrats versus Democrats, there's the opposite dynamic.
Because political considerations are allowed under this framing, whereas racial ones are not.
Right.
Or they can't be.
Well, they have to be limited, right?
Understood. Okay, well, I know we're approaching the top of the hour, so I'll pose a last question and take host prerogative. You've given us sort of a framing of, hey, here's what we know, here are the justices that are undecided. Do you have a read of what the issues that sort of are going to be determinative will be? So we're not sure where people are going to break out, but like this will probably be the thing where people split or agree.
I think you're going to have some justices who are not comfortable deferring to a preliminary decision by a lower court. So some justices are just the Alito and probably Gorsuch are not going to be comfortable saying, oh, you got this preliminary ruling that said we think you need to create a second majority minority district, so go ahead and consider race to an extent that would be unconstitutional otherwise. I don't think they're going to buy into that, but I do think that justices on the other end are going to accept that the state needs to be able to rely on what those lower courts say. So that issue, I'm fairly confident, is going to divide the court, and whether something else gets involved as well is a little bit more difficult to say.
Sounds good. Well, thank you so much for taking this section of your afternoon and your morning to listen to oral argument and share your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We can wrap up and are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.